third case, Doc Hodge versus Philip, 08-2554. Mr. Sharma Crawford.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is William Sharma Crawford, and I'm an attorney for the Doc Hodge family. There are two main issues at play here, and somewhat in an analogous relationship to the case the court just heard. This is about the receipt of notice of Mr. Doc Hodge's briefing schedule. The court indicates, the court being the Board of Immigration Appeals in their November 2007 decision, indicates that their rationale is that we sent it by mail, so you must have received it. There is no further analysis as to, in response to our motion to reopen. Mr. Doc Hodge indicates that the only thing that he received that provided him notice that he was due to write his brief, and at that time he was pro se. He was pro se at trial, he was pro se on the appeal, and at the time that notice went out, he was still pro se. He received the government's brief, as they had responded basically to say, we're not going to write a brief, you should uphold the immigration judge's decision. He received his properly served copy of that, and that alerted him that he was due to write a brief. He came to our office. We put forth an affidavit stating that he had not received it. We contacted counsel to get a record, or at least a copy of the decision, so we could create some kind of motion, and we put forth a motion to accept a brief out of time. The board denied that in their November decision, and then we have filed an amended notice of appeal to put all of the issues of Mr. Doc Hodge's appeal before the board. That was post the November decision. Then the board issued a general denial of the case in June of 2008, in which they mentioned circumspectually our amended notice of appeal, but called it a method by which we sought to circumvent their denial of our motion to accept the late file brief. The government, in their brief, takes us to task to say that we didn't put forth the problems of trial properly and did not exhaust our administrative remedies because Mr. Doc Hodge could have put it in his first notice of appeal, which brings us back around circle to the issue of notice and receipt. In October 31st of 2008, the board itself issued a decision, matter of MRA, found at 24 INN decision 665. And in that, they discuss, in the context of an abstention order, how you overcome the presumptive delivery of putting something in regular mail. And they outline several facts. An affidavit from the respondent or his family, the respondent's actions upon learning that this abstention order had been issued, prior affirmative applications for relief. Did the respondent have a reason to participate in the judiciary system or in this system? And then previous attendance at immigration court and other circumstances. If we take the MRA standard and apply it to Mr. Doc Hodge's case at hand, then he merits remand as held out in MRA. He filed an affidavit indicating he didn't receive notice. He immediately acted upon learning that he was due to file a brief. He contacted us, and we filed a motion to accept the brief out of time. He had a prior application where he appeared pro se. Many of the hearings before or his difficulties with prior counsel, and not only prior counsel, but us, as we were employed by another firm, and the separation from that firm and losing track of us caused him to be essentially unrepresented. But he showed up for court, he participated in court, and he filed his appeal. So he clearly had an interest in the proceedings. So it isn't that he would have arbitrarily ignored his duty because that wasn't the pattern of behavior he had before, which matter of MRA held to be important. And his previous attendance, again, he was at immigration court. He testified. He acted in his own defense and continued to act affirmatively in his immigration matter.
Sending this matter back to the BIA be an exercise in futility?
I would hope not, that they would look at it and reopen it to allow us to brief the matter fully and then make a decision and bring it back. Could it be sent back to the immigration judge for a whole hearing? Certainly. We believe there are many errors at the immigration judge level. If this court feels that we have properly preserved those for review, we feel that the credibility finding doesn't distinguish specific cogent reasons, that it relies on trivial discrepancies in the record, that the translator had some serious issues. We feel that the flaw exists at the trial level and should be redone.
You do admit that now that the petitioner's wife did have an opportunity to testify.
I believe she did, clearly, Your Honor, and I believe that their statement is encapsulated in that if you read the beginning of the hearing, she's apparently sitting next to him. And in that courtroom that was in Kansas City, it is a small room with no windows, and you literally sit next to each other. It's a series of tables and a television set. And so she was moved because I believe there was some discussion between the parties. And she was answering questions with him. I don't dispute that she was called to the stand and allowed to testify. We do believe that there were some significant translator issues that frustrated them.
So the board would really have to accept your explanation before
correct.
It would probably allow you to brief the issues. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that the board is singling out that and calling it fraudulent, and I don't know that that was the DeCage's intent to defraud the board and the claim that they had not been.
Well, counsel, if we were to reach the merits on the present record, is the government correct that you have not properly exhausted any of the questions you're now raising here?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they are. And I believe, as I've stated, that we properly preserve them by filing an amended notice of appeal to the board. And again, the board in its second decision in 2008 gives that amended notice of appeal short shrift to say, well, you filed it to circumvent our prior notice, but yet doesn't rule on it to say we're not accepting it or that it's mechanically improper or regulatorily improper.
Doesn't the board have discretionary authority as to whether to allow an amended notice of appeal?
Arguably they do, but they also have a duty to provide, as the court writes, not an exegesis on everything, but certainly some analysis as to why they wouldn't accept it or why they wouldn't take it.
Discretionary. Do we have jurisdiction to review their refusal?
You do, as according to Gutierrez-Almazan, 491 F. 3rd, 341, from this court in 07, it is this very issue, whether or not a motion to reopen a case before the board is accepted and you apply an abusive discretion standard for it, arbitrary and capricious. And I don't believe that Wang and the others have considered it and overruled it. It appears to still be good law before this court. And I'm at my white light. If there are any other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Adelimo?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Remy Adelimo, and I am here on behalf of the Attorney General. The petition for review should be denied. This is a fact-bound case with no major issue of law at stake. Here we're dealing with a case management issue, and the question is whether the board abused its discretion in denying petitioner's late filed brief. And the simple answer is no. The board was merely policing its own administrative rules, and the board is free to come up with its own rules of practice so long as they are reasonable. And in this case, the board was reasonable. The board's discretion is extremely greater here, where it is determining the circumstances under which it would accept a late filed brief. Petitioners point to matter of MRA and matter of CRC in their 28J letter as evidence that the board may have abused its discretion. But our position is that those cases do not apply, and they have no bearing whatsoever to the outcome of this case. Those decisions apply within the context of an in absentia order of removal, where there is a statutory right to notice. In this case, there is no statutory mandate for filing a brief.
So we're going to have two different tests for determining whether a letter arrives?
Well, Your Honor, our position is basically that those cases do not apply. They were specifically, the board was specifically dealing with the case of in absentia orders of removal where notice is a statutory right.
Have our other sister circuits made the distinction that you're making now?
Pardon me?
Have our sister circuits made the distinction that you are making now?
Well, this is because these cases are so new, they have not really been fully tested yet in the courts of appeals. That is the matter of MRA and matter of CRC. But the government's position is that those cases were in the context of an in absentia order of removal and do not apply to this case. And even if they did, Your Honor, the board was not arbitrary or capricious in its decision. It followed the standards outlined in those cases, even though this case was determined before those two cases were issued by the board. The board specifically stated that the claims in petitioner's affidavit was self-serving. It basically, they had no other affidavits from any other person stating that they had, maybe who lived with them, stating that they had, they didn't get the letter. They basically, in their affidavit, they did not state that they were having problems receiving mail. At that address, they received everything that had been sent by the board.
Let's take a step back, though. Why should we have two tests? I mean, what rationale can you give me in law for why there should be two different tests to determine whether a guy's gotten a letter or not?
Well, I'm not really saying that there should be two tests.
That sounds like how many angels should dance on the head of a pen, to be very frank.
Yes, Your Honor, I'm not really saying that there should be two tests, Your Honor, but basically the issue is that even if those two cases applied to this case, the board did not abuse its discretion. The board basically analyzed the issue and provided cogent and specific reasons. It pointed to the fact that petitioner had made a false claim in a notice of appeal, and therefore use that as a basis for not giving weight to the affidavits that the petitioners submitted. That was one issue. Basically, another issue is that petitioners had the chance in their notice of appeal to state with specificity the claims that they were going to make on appeal, which they failed to. They had a two-line statement there, which goes to show the pattern of carelessness of the petitioners in handling this appeal. They had every opportunity, and the board has unfettered discretion in this case to handle its caseload and its case management.
Does the board have an obligation to be even-handed?
Certainly the board has an obligation to be even-handed, and in this case it was, Your Honor. The board gave very specific and cogent reasons. It was not arbitrary or capricious at all. I mean, the board reviews numerous requests for that failed to comply with the timing restrictions, Your Honor. And the board is best positioned to decide which cases are sufficiently exceptional from its perspective.
Has the board been making this distinction that you urge on us in cases subsequent to the MRA case and the CRC case? Have they been making this distinction between situations where there's a statutory right and situations where there is not, with respect to the test they use to determine if a letter has been delivered?
As I said, Your Honor, this is a very new case, and it's almost an issue of first impression, and there
is
many things.
So this is something the litigation arm of immigration is trying out on us, is that right?
Well, not necessarily, Your Honor. We're just trying to put forth our position and...
But you've given me no rationale for why we should have these two different tests.
Actually, Your
Honor...
Why
should a person have... Why should the test be different when you get a letter pursuant to a statute and when you simply get a letter pursuant to the board's usual process?
Well, there shouldn't be two standards, Your Honor, and I'm not advocating that there should be two standards. All I'm saying is that those cases were issued in the context of an in absentia order of removal where a notice is a statutory required mandate.
But unless you can give me a reason why those cases should be distinguished from this one, a reason... It's a distinction without a difference.
But even, Your Honor, even if those cases do apply in this case, the board did not abuse its discretion. It followed the mandate as outlined in those cases as to what should be done. It was not an arbitrary and capricious decision, as petitioner would have the court believe.
I have your point. Yes, thanks.
Okay. So basically, because the board has numerous requests that fail to comply with the timing restrictions, the board is indeed best positioned to decide which cases are sufficiently exceptional from its perspective to justify the acceptance of a late-filed brief. Heckler v. Cheney, for instance, does say that the agency actually is far better equipped than the courts to deal with the many variables involved in a proper ordering of its priorities. And the board has done so in this case.
Help me out. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Continue your thought, and then I've got a question.
Okay. Basically, the board was merely policing its own administrative rules in this case. Petitioners have shown a pattern of carelessness. They basically did not file for asylum within 1 year of arrival in the United States. They did not seek the help of an attorney until after their briefing schedule had passed. They had every opportunity to get an attorney to work on their case before the case went to trial, and they didn't try hard enough to basically follow the rules to show that they had actually taken specific efforts to ensure that their case would be properly heard.
Now, if I may just shift the focus, maybe you can help me out in another area. Suppose we were to reach the merits of the case. What substantive issues, in your view, are properly before us now?
The only issue before the court now are basically what was before the board in the original notice of appeal. Any other issue filed after that is not before the court.
Which is basically that
the petitioner's wife did not have an opportunity to be heard, which petitioners have essentially said is a false claim, and the fact that the board did misrepresented country conditions, did not state what the country conditions were. Those are the only issues properly before this court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. So for those reasons, Your Honor, this petition for review must be dismissed. The board was not arbitrary or capricious in its decision. The board court held that all the relevant evidence must be considered. That is, in this case, the board and the courts have issued decisions that says all relevant evidence must be considered, and the board did consider all the circumstantial evidence in this case. They basically did not just arbitrarily rule that petitioners do not have a right to file their brief. They looked at all the evidence, the fact that petitioners filed a false claim, and that basically weighed in on petitioners, on the board's decision to not give weight to petitioners' affidavits. There was also the two-line statement of in the appeal, which shows that petitioners did not take their case seriously. And all those factors noted against the board's decision to deny petitioner the opportunity to file their brief. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Sharma Crawford.
Counsel, perhaps you'd be kind enough in your rebuttal to address your opposing counsel's view that, in effect, the board substantially complied with their new test in any event.
I'd like to, Your Honor. I'd first like to cover one piece that the language issue always bothers me. We're not asserting that the claim respondent's wife didn't get to testify is a false claim. I think I made clear in my initial argument that their impression was based on several aspects that she didn't get to say her piece. I'm not disputing that she was called and that she testified, but certainly there was no intent to defraud or make a false statement to the board. The matter of MRA test specifically dealt with presumptive delivery by regular mail. That was the issue in front of the court in MRA, and they outlined several categories which I put forth in my initial argument that the board is now going to consider as to whether or not the presumption of delivery by regular mail has been overcome. We feel that if you make that analysis, petitioners have done so. They provided the affidavits. They showed up for court. They did those activities which the board attributed to people who are interested in their case and would have acted properly had they had proper notice, which was the holding of MRA. The board, in its November 2007 decision, really makes no analysis of its denial of the motion to reopen. They say that the affidavits are self-serving and insufficient, and that's the end of the analysis. So while counsel seeks to say that it's not an arbitrary and capricious decision, I don't know what it is. I mean, there's nothing for me to look at to say, here is what the board thought or felt or reasoned in arguably either decision. The 2008 decision, the June 2008 decision, the final denial, is a little more contemplative, but it is more that there's a false claim in there. You tried to circumvent our other denial, and so we're just going to deny you in general. We feel that we are upholding the immigration judge's decision. Is a relatively accurate analysis of their decision. There is no analysis to say that the judge was correct. There is no analysis to say why we're dismissing your amended notice of appeal, which brings out the faults of the immigration judge's decision. In MRA and CRC, at least in MRA, it's actually a well-reasoned decision in the sense that they go through and look at the circuit decisions that apply to the concept of receipt of regular mail or the rebuttal of presumption. They cite specifically immediately to the Second Circuit, Lopez v. Gonzalez, 468 F3rd 81 in 2006, Santana Gonzalez v. Attorney General of the United States out of the Third Circuit, 506 F3rd 274 2007. They also cite to the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, the Tenth, and the 11th, even though the 11th is arguably a stiffer standard. And my apologies, in my preparation last night, I didn't write down all those decisions to give to you now, but they are found in MRA. It's a relatively exhaustive list of what the current circuit holding is. Now, sadly, they don't cite a decision from the 7th, but they do say that this is how they're going to analyze the delivery of regular mail.
Did your client ever have an opportunity to explain to the board why he made the allegation that his wife did not have a chance to testify?
I don't believe we did, Your Honor. I mean, arguably the opportunity was there. We could have cleaned it to some extent in the amended notice of appeal to say this is what we were saying, but we were trying to get in the fill the deficiencies in their claim. The last piece, and I know I'm out of time, Your Honor, is I don't believe that Mr. Dakaj was careless. Immigration law has been noted to be one of the most complicated areas of law. They held their own trial. They filed their own notice of appeal. They did everything they could, which is more than some attorneys who dabble in immigration law are capable of doing. I don't believe they were careless at all. I think they did the best they could as pro se litigants, and the Supreme Court has asked that the courts hold the filings of pro se litigants or at least treat them liberally. If there's nothing further, Your Honors, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you both, counsel. And our fourth case was dismissed.